everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Ciaffardini. Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast. I can't even get the words out. The podcast experience. This is going to be something that's going to sit with you in your heart, in your soul, in your pelvis area for the rest of your life. I have my good friend by my side, co-host with the Mo-host, Brian Kluger, joining us. We are the Twin Titans of Dallas, and we're speaking to two amazing musicians, two men of a three-piece outfit, for all the way from Toronto, Canada. We're speaking to Dean Rode and Martin McPhail, talking about music. It's a very small, concise word that means a lot to a lot of people. So, Brian, welcome. Dean and Martin, thanks for being on the show. How are things in your world?
Yeah, thanks for having us, man. Things are good. I'm in Los Angeles right now. We're sort of scattered to the wind at the moment. Diener, you're up in PA, right?
Yeah, I'm up in British Columbia, Canada. It's pretty beautiful here, but we're pretty spread apart right now. That's kind of what our life has been, working remotely from each other. That's kind of the 2025 vibe these days, but yeah.
kind of reminds me about 5 years ago, wouldn't you say? Kind of.
Yeah, really something similar. Happened 5 years ago, right? Yeah.
I can't remember what that was, but something. Yeah, we.
It's like a hangover, trying to forget about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is our sort of modus operandi these days, is being a little bit scattered all over the place. Obviously being in Los Angeles as much as we can and working hands-on with directors and films and things like that. But a lot of the films we do are shot and finished in Canada as well, or we spend a lot of time on the East Coast these days with the film you mentioned, Queens of the Dead, which was all a very New York East Coast kind of project. So we were out there for that as well. But it's a rare and special thing that we're actually all in one place these days.
So, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So you guys hail from the Great White North. That's so funny because Brian and I have long been consumers and connoisseurs of your culture. We've been steeping ourselves in mythology the past couple of years. Brian, let's see how well they would we pass for commoners.
All right, let's do it.
Hey, good buddy. Hey, Brian. How are you now?
Good, and you?
Not so bad. That's all we got. That's really
that's
all we got.
That's pretty good.
That was pretty
your
good.
Spare parts, bud.
You have to add a few more A's in there, though.
Yeah, a few more buddies.
And sorries. A lot more sorries.
Okay. Yeah,
that's a Texas size 10-4 good buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of buddy. Oh, fucking buddy. Wait, can I see your own? Is that okay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
A lot of that, too. Casual bombs, but yeah, that's pretty good, guys. It's pretty good. You've got it. It's coming along. You got to throw in some more Canadian slang, though. You got to work.
I'd say you pass the test. You get a C plus.
Yeah, get into the country.
A for effort, F for execution. And I am. I'm going to be the host. Tight shirt, huge pecs. Brian's going to go plastic below the waist. And Dean, are you of the Rode dynasty? Do you have a sound technology in your lifeblood, your lineage? Rode mics.
Oh, because I always see those mics. I wish I did. I wish I could have a discount for those Rode mics, but no, I'm not related in any way.
Okay.
Yeah, Dynasty would come in handy, but your name was originally spelled with the H in there, right?
It was. My grandpa came over from Germany, and they misspelt the name on the way in, and he rolled with it. So that's what happened. That was the story.
Classic story.
Yeah.
Rode in hard, ended up in Canada. Sounds like an amazing story. So you guys are Blitz / Berlin. Please, before we get into that, Brian and I like to go in the way back machine getting to know you. We'd like to know kind of like what your childhoods were like. What movies grabbed your attention? What singles you had on cassette? Things you would ride bikes and pretend you were driving straight through the moon with?
Sure, man. Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, one of the most interesting things in our group specifically is that Dean and Tristan, who is MIA today, met when you guys were what, 3 years old? Or no, sorry, not 3 years. When grade three, right?
We met in T-ball actually.
Yeah.
We didn't even go to the same school. We played T-ball and Yeah, and then from there, eventually we re-met in high school because that's where we went to the same high school and played in school bands together. So I played bass, he played drums, and we played in jazz bands, pit orchestras, things like that together at school. So that's how we rekindled it, and that's how we knew each other. And then, Martin, I'll let you take it away from here.
I met these guys in high school. And we started our first band together at that point. And we were playing in a punk band forever, touring across Canada and the States and playing every little random bar. And until we moved to Toronto and got our first record deal and all that stuff. And the band went through this big metamorphosis, which resulted in us making some experimental music and then getting in touch with some filmmakers and beginning to score film. So really our first sort of swing at this and making music together was all about touring and playing punk music. So it wasn't really as movie focused. That being said, we're big movie fans and growing up on those things was a big deal. For me, I mean, you mentioned the riding the bike to the moon. Old school Spielberg was for sure very formative. E.T. and Close Encounters, big movies for me. I've always been a big sci-fi guy. Obviously Star Wars, Indiana Jones, less than
Alien.
Kind of. Alien, absolutely, when I was a little older, as a kid, a little scary. And yeah, Blade Runner. I actually have a formative memory of being homesick. I had like strep throat and, you know, it was in maybe the end of elementary school. It was home for like weeks on end. And my dad went to our local video store called Crazy Mike's. Shout out Crazy Mike's. I don't think it's still there, but that place.
Ruled. It's gone. It's long gone.
Is it gone?
Yeah, it's long gone.
Dreams yeah. crushed.
I love this place. Yeah. You know, it was like the indie video rental store you could go to. And he brought home these stack of VHSs for me. And there was Blade Runner. There was Big Trouble in Little China, of all movies. Hell yeah. There was Commando. And something else that I'm forgetting, but that's actually a pretty good summation of my taste as a kid, is that ranging from sci-fi to just like Arnie action. So when it came time to start making movies or making music for movies, it was something that we never really knew, that guys that came into music the way that we did, we didn't know this was a job you could have. You know, you figured, oh, if you're a composer, you go to like composer school or something. So when we started to get opportunities to score that stuff, it's very exciting because of how much, you know, we were such big movie fans growing up, but didn't think we'd ever really get to play in that playground. Dieter, I know you grew up playing baseball, and so like movies like The Sandlot and stuff were huge for you, right?
Yeah, The Sandlot was massive. Bull Durham, I watched all those movies. Bull Durham's a classic, of course. But yeah, I'm on the same kind of wavelength as Martin. I watched Blade Runner, all the Star Wars. I was a big fan, like all those types of old classics. But go ahead, Martin. Sorry.
I was going to say, we don't have a very like cool answer for this. So I'm going to be like, it's definitely like German expressionist filmmaking. You know?
No. That's not the answer we're looking for. We're looking for the answers you gave. And I will say that you brought up Big Trouble in Little China.
Hell yeah.
Mark Chaffardini can do, he does, like every time we meet up here in Dallas, Texas, he will do the entire monologue from Egg Chen going around Chinatown, giving the whole tour thing, and he could do it verbatim.
Incredible. It's wow. I figured you were going to say he does like the Pork Chop Express routine, you know, the like.
No, does the Egg Chen routine, and it's so
incredible.
Good.
And that's the unexpected thing. Like everybody would think it's like, you know, like I told my last wife, honey, I never drive faster than I can see. But it's like when you bring up Egg Shen, it's like, holy crap, you know? And it just shows I mean, the things that you said, exactly like Brian said, that's not what we want. You didn't want to hear Merchant Ivory Pictures or something like that. Yeah, we want to say, like, I have a Canon tattoo. I have Orion, you know, posters that I stole from the movie store or something like that.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
That's the way to do it. And then going off about your high school and love of music, I mean, you all grew up together in Canada, which feels almost kind of really cinematic, a setting for to start a band, kind of like the high school corridors, the Canadian cafeteria food, that scent of teenage rebellion. When did your friendship turn into a full-blown love affair with music? And more specifically, with the particular brand of sound that would become your own?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, I mean, when we began the band in the first place, honestly, we didn't think it would last all that long. It was kind of for fun in a short-term thing, but then it clicked in a way that just became this like soul food for us, where it became our lives really quickly. But I would say what really like cemented us as friends for life, but also as you put it, the lifelong love affair with music as a vocation, was the crucible of touring Canada in the winter, 100%. Because you cannot come in with an idea of like glamour or rock stardom or something and have that survive touring Canada in the winter. You can't. You
yeah, that's when you really become bros.
Well, you have to. I mean, you literally have to hold each other at night in the van where you're sleeping because it's minus 30 outside. Like, you know, it was the kind of experience. I mean, we literally had one situation that comes to mind where we were in the middle of nowhere, our driving on the highway at, like, you know, whatever, 70 miles an hour, and go to slow down a little bit, press the brakes, and the headlights of the van go out. And, like, and it's pitch black, middle of the night. So we're like, oh my God. So take foot off the brakes, headlights sort of come back on, but very weakly. And we're like, okay, we gotta, something's wrong. So we coast to the side of the road. There's no streetlights, there's no cars. We're in the middle, like, middle of nowhere highway, like probably 100 miles from anything in any direction. And coast the side of the road, and we're noticing the engine is making a really weird noise. We're like, turn it off. We turn off the vehicle, but the engine keeps making the noise. So we yell, abandon ship, and we all just get out of the van expecting it to explode, which it didn't, but it was undrivable. So we had to get towed to a local place. This is like, I don't know what, Dean, probably like minus 10, minus 15 outside Celsius.
It was more. It was like minus 20. And to add to your story, we were going back to a house where we left all our warm clothes because we were 19 or 20 and very stupid. Yeah. And so we left all our jackets at this house that we were going back to. So we were all cuddling in the van for warmth for a while there. But we must have been 19 or 20, but go on, Marty. Sorry.
We were done. We didn't bring our stuff. We were freezing cold. We got towed to a local town, and this happened to be Easter weekend. So nothing was open. So we spent a good amount of time huddled together in, like, the entryway of a bank where you can do, like, your ATM card, you know, just to, like, stay warm and try to get a hold of anybody that could help us out of the situation. So we ended up, by the good grace of strangers, getting our vehicle fixed, getting back on the road later that day. But that was one of the longest nights of our young lives, where there was definitely moments where, like, you know, you're sniping at each other, just be like, this is your fault, like, you should have checked the whatever. And, like, I remember Elliot specifically, our guitarist at the time, like, chucking the lid of the merch bin because he was looking for something warm to wear and throwing it in such a way that it, like, clocked Tristan, like, just about, you know, cleared his top. And all those things, by the end of that, when you're still friends and you still love each other and you still want to be on the road, you know that you're in it for the right reasons. You're in it for life, because no part of this is comfortable or glamorous. This is purely for the love of the game. So
And that's a great story, and that you just kind of described almost kind of like an orchestra tuning up and all coming together to, like, play something, you know, like, that's like all these functions coming together. No, that's a great story.
I mean, that's a wonderfully poetic way to put it. I'm not sure which part of the orchestra is where you throw the violin and hit the other guy with your instrument, but, you know, we all do it in our own ways. But for sure, this crucible, these years on the road, touring in the winter, by the time we started making music in a different way, we had this sort of this language that's nonverbal between us, just like a band jamming in a room, that has helped us so much with our film score process.
It's also been a very non-traditional route to film composing compared to, I think, a lot of people. So, you know, doing the rock band, alternative band type of composition, and changing that all to timpanis and orchestra and everything. So there's a lot that I think helped us, but obviously we're not, you know, a traditional route like a lot of film composers.
Yeah, which I think has been a challenge and a strength. We're definitely doing things the wrong way a lot of the time, but I think that by virtue of our lack of knowledge in the beginning, is what gave us a very unique sound and got us a lot of our jobs in the early days. And it's something we've tried to, you know, we know a lot more about this job now, and we can, you know, have a lot more flexible tonally, but we still try to keep that DIY punk rock approach to things, just being like, well, we could just, like, record an instrument here, or we could do something super weird to get that same sound. Let's try to reinvent how we approach this. So
that's awesome, and that leads me just to something that came up, like, you're just talking about these sounds, you know, like, punk rock has always been the art of making the wrong sound feel right, and you've taken that ethos and blown it up into something completely symphonic. Out of all the unorthodox noises you've experimented with, what's the one that caught you off guard? Something you expected to be ridiculous only to discover it was perfect.
I wouldn't say ridiculous, but I think we really got into the hydraulic sounds, and those, when you affect them with a little bit of distortion and pitch them way up, they sound like almost a wraith scream from Lord of the Rings.
That
So
really high pitch, yeah.
we really got into the industrial sounds, and part of that is because we're super into Nine Inch Nails and other bands like that, with industrial elements. It's yeah.
There's
How about you,
also
Marty?
there's a building in Victoria called the Center of the Universe, which is like an observatory that's up on a mountain near where we grew up, run by the university, and it's like a super old dome, kind of like they have here in Los Angeles, like Mount Wilson. But basically the observatory dome, it covers the telescope, and then it's this super old like pulley and wire system to move this plate of metal around to like reveal the telescope for a view into the night. But the thing just essentially screams the whole time. So we were like, and recorded that, and that's one of those sounds too that inspired a lot of things for us, is that grinding, shrieking metal sound from our environment. That
Very
being
cool.
said, I'll say that the most unexpected one was for a film we did called Stillborn, and there's prominent use of a breast pump in the film, and the motor for that breast pump ended up becoming basically our percussion suite, essentially, for that. So many of the rhythms and the drones and the like glitchy little beat things that happen are all made from the motor in that pump. So that one was one of those weird ideas that we're like, this will probably suck, but we got to try it. And then it ended up actually being kind of cool for the film. So
I'd
you
say
never know.
one more would be a mic recording of Martin's watch clicking, and we use that
Oh
as
yeah.
pacing. So
Man, I
that was
got this
pretty
dirt
fun.
cheap watch, and it like looked like an expensive watch. It was like $40, but it was the loudest watch I've ever heard in my life. Like right now in this conversation, you'd be able to hear it over me talking probably. And we're like, we gotta use, I can't wear it, but we gotta use it somehow, you know?
That's
So
incredible. Somewhere Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys' his ears perked up, you know?
yeah, 100%. This is like the very lo-fi poor guy Christopher Nolan Zimmer story. That was a nice watch that they used. We used
Yeah,
a
we
really bad watch.
not the same quality.
No.
That's great.
Well, speaking of Zimmer, one of the things that makes his music so captivating and entrancing is that he designs it and composes it in a way that it's simple. It may be complex and you orchestrate it so it sounds complicated, but like you can play time from inception with one finger, or so curious, what goes into your approach? If you are sampling something and it's an ethereal sound or something, like how do you turn that into something that feels like a suite or builds on it?
Yeah, I mean, to me, they feel like those two things are sort of like different ingredients to bake the cake. I'm going with cake. To bake the cake, these are different ingredients. I
We
feel
like
like
food here. Keep going. Keep going.
okay, great. I'm a big cake guy, let me tell you. People give me shit for eating muffins in the morning. They say that's breakfast cake, and I say, what's wrong with that? I love breakfast cake. But what I was gonna say is that writing this, the simplicity of melody, I think, is something that we hold pretty sacred and is really, really important. And oftentimes that is what we start with. So when we're writing, talking about Star Wars and Indiana Jones, obviously John Williams, one of the best to ever do it. The wonderful thing about his orchestrations or his arrangements, if you listen to them, is that obviously you can walk out of a theater and you can hum the Imperial March or the Force theme or any of that stuff. They're so easy. And again, you can play them with one finger, dun, 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 and you're in, it's Star Wars. But you listen to those actual arrangements, and they are insanely complicated. The amount of polyrhythms and various instruments and textures that are happening all with live instruments, and yet the simplicity of the melody pokes through. So to me, and I think the way that we write as a group is there's sort of two different parts. So for something like I mentioned, like sampling that little motor, we're not going to get a melodic theme from that, but that's going to give a flavor to the score that is unique for that film. It's going to be a tech something textural. So we experiment with that simultaneously as we're experimenting with the simplest version of writing. What are the little bits of melody? What are the little bits of theme that feel like they hit the right points? Either they're unsettling enough or sad enough or whatever that can we can associate with character emotions. Then marrying those two things is kind of where the cake is baked. We're going with cake. It's a matter of those two different things. It's less that the experimental sounds evolve into themes, although potentially they could inspire that, but more that these are almost two different sides of the brain, and then the way that those combine is what I think can make a score feel original and exciting.
It's awesome. Very cool. And I mean, with that music in the film work, I went to film school 25 years ago. I grew up playing clarinet and saxophone the way Woody Allen did. A blind spot I didn't know I had, film scores and trailer scores aren't the same thing. And apparently, most people don't know this. Can you walk me through that difference? And kind of while we're at it, how do you even begin to compress the sprawl of a 90-minute score into 2 minutes that need to grab someone by the collar?
Man, I mean, you're talking about a revelation that we had exactly like that in maybe 10 years ago-ish when we first started getting into this business. Because first of all, we didn't know that, yeah, the movie trailer business just seemed like it would be affectionately of the movie business, you know? Like if Paramount Pictures has a big film coming out and then they have a guy scoring it, then they're just gonna have like an editor cut a trailer because they have all this wonderful score and picture. Why wouldn't they? Not the way it works at all. The trailer industry itself is worth millions and millions of dollars a year and has all these competing companies, which are companies that only do trailers. So they don't make films or TV
Crazy.
shows. They just do trailers, and that is big money, big business. And not only is the film composer typically not involved in that part of it, but oftentimes the music doesn't resemble anything that's in the film. There's notable exceptions. Like if you're doing a Star Wars trailer, you can't not have a Star Wars theme in there somewhere. But even so, a lot of those Star Wars trailers, they're doing it at a time when the score hasn't even been recorded for the film yet. So like they know the themes, but they're going to have a trailer composer adapt John Williams' themes and record them in something that will never appear in the film and never be officially released. It will only exist in the trailer as a unique piece of music. And that's a lot of the trailer work that we've done falls into that capacity, including probably our biggest trailer job being Top Gun Maverick was
Right,
exactly
because it
that.
was the Top Gun theme, like that in the slowed down epic version of it.
Exactly. And we, I mean, that's a pretty good microcosm of what it's like working in trailers because that one was so NDA'd and so they were so paranoid about leaks of any type. We were brought onto the project while they were still shooting it, and we were not allowed to see a shred of footage or read a piece of a script or have anything even in writing. So what we actually composed to from that was a description over the phone from a wonderful music supervisor here in Los Angeles read out basically the trailer script to us. With a verbal agreement that we weren't going to record what he was saying, like that there the security was nuts, and so he's Maverick, you should be a 4-star general by now, and it's like, yeah, why are you still flying or whatever, like read out the beats of it, and then was like, okay, so here's what we need musically. We need like a bit of suspense off the top, but let's hear that iconic bell from the first one, and then we need some like rising action and rhythm in the middle, and then we need to really explode into our classic theme and feel that nostalgic thing. That's all we got, and that's what we composed to was that description, never seeing any picture. And certainly not having any access to the score, which I don't think had been composed yet. So, very weird business that way. Horse before the cart, as you might say.
And on our end, it's completely different composition because it's like lots of the time you have to make a Big Mac for them. So you have to have like the recipe of, just like Martin said, an intro, a middle section, and a big epic ending. But it's also the timeline a lot of the time is 48 hours or 72 hours to finish it rather than a full film where you're doing it in a couple months typically. So for us, it was very strange being forced to write that quickly. So that got us out of our comfort zone. But we did learn how to do it. Then the three of us trading off really helps. So yeah.
Yeah, that's 100% the case. The timeline is something I hadn't mentioned, and that is a huge component of it, is it's always an insane rush. So also, obviously, you don't have the ability to record a live orchestra in that amount of time. So you have to pull out every trick in the book to try to make stuff in the box that you're doing sound as huge and as competitive and as much like a Hans Zimmer score as you can in 2 days on a laptop, essentially, you know?
No, it's my mind's fucking blown. I just figured, like you said, it's like an orchestra. You're taking bits and editing bits here, but y'all are doing it. Y'all are in from a fucking phone call of reading of the script
Yeah,
to
I know.
tell that. It's mind blowing.
Just wild. That one was a crazy project and not uncommon to have that kind of thing. Nowadays, especially being based in Los Angeles, we sometimes get the benefit of being able to go into these houses and watch some footage in person, but that's like put your phone in a lockbox kind of thing. Like security is really, really number one. A different situation is Queens of the Dead, which we were mentioning, which has its LA premiere coming up at Beyond Fest here. Yeah, that is one which is one of these rare cases where we scored the film, and then IFC also came to us to do the trailer score. So in that case, we get to cheat because we have the score files. We know what the film sounds like. We can pull them in and edit them and make them cool and whatever. And that's sort of what we did for the Queen's trailer. So a lot of what you hear in there are adaptations of the score, but that's a less common situation.
Yeah, it's most of the films we do score, we don't do the trailers for. So we were very happy to do that one. So
cool.
Well, it almost sounds like, you know, with such a short time frame, it sounds like you guys are at the fair. You know that the carnival games, there's the one where you're climbing a rope ladder and you're very close to toppling over. What happens if you're, you know, 3 hours from deadline, and you're like, we got nothing? Or, you know, it's just not like, it's not Blitz Berlin quality stamp. Like, what's the second take?
Oh, man. I mean, a lot of
times.
That's
definitely happened.
Well, for sure it's happened, but a lot of times there's not time to start over or to ruminate or to go and, you know, do some soul searching about it. I think something that really it teaches you over time is to pretty quickly get excited about something, have an idea, and then like, that's going to be the idea. So you got to bring it to completion, make it as good as possible and deliver it on time. Maybe if you'd had a week to try a bunch of different things, it would have been different, but you don't, and neither does anybody else. So I think it teaches you to form your first instincts quite quickly and then to trust them. Mm-hmm. It certainly doesn't always work. It is a crazy, crazy process. Most of the work we do these days is film and TV work with some trailers on the side, mainly because it's such a wild business in that way that can be fun, but it can also be, you know, exhausting. And you could have 10 of those pitches for these huge films that you feel very positive about, and you only had 48 hours for each one, and you might land one or you might land zero. That could have all been a bunch of work for, you know, not a lot of
games.
Yeah, the creative, just having the creative part of it be a part of it. So sometimes, as everyone knows, if you're a painter or anyone, sometimes it flows, and then sometimes you hit a wall and you try all you can, but you can't get the idea down. So that happens to us too. But you still have to complete it, and you still have to send it through.
You do, and I think it's something that is. Strength of ours is, or something I shouldn't say a strength, something we're very fortunate to have, is the fact that we make music as the three of us instead of just being a single composer, really allows us to roll off of writer's block in a way where we can stay making stuff. Because if Diener starts track and hits a wall and being like, I've used all my ideas and it's not sounding right yet, like that's the time to pass it off. And that's when we, you know, can fill in each other's ideas. Because half the time when he's saying that, I'm going to listen to it, be like, oh, this is amazing, and I know exactly what to do, or vice versa. So it's a bit of a superpower that we have, I think, to be able to have three of us that have played together for this long, that trust each other's instincts and are kind of good at filling in those gaps.
That's cool. I love that. And before my next question, I just have to mention, since you're talking about some of the movies you scored, Mark and I were at Fantastic Fest in Austin this past week, and we watched the world premiere of Silent Night, Deadly Night remake.
Nice. And that's right. The secret screening.
Awesome. Yeah, Mike P. Nelson is a very good friend of mine. He's been on My Bloody Podcast and Fear and Loathing in Cinema podcast numerous times. And I'm just watching it and hearing the music for it, seeing y'all's name in the credits, and I can't wait for everybody to see this movie. So, I know we're not going to talk about it today because it's so far out there, but I was really excited, and we have mutual friends.
Amazing. That's great, man. Yeah, we love Mike. This was our first collaboration with him. And it was a crazy process, but seeing the reactions to this film already is really exciting. I can't wait for everyone to see it.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. But going back to the questions, making a regular album is one thing, kind of like punk or rock. Scoring a film feels like another beast entirely. One's a playlist for a party, and the other's kind of like the bloodstream of a big cinematic story. How different is the process for y'all? And, you know, going back to the culinary jokes, how is the sausage made from that first spark to final cut?
Man, sausage and cake together at last.
Yeah.
First of all, I can tell you guys are both writers. You must be, because like your phrasing is so poetic in these questions. I have to say.
Well, thank you, thank you.
A lot like you guys, we got close in a car somewhere outside of Austin. We formed and forged our lyricism that way.
Okay, we gotta hear more about that on a different type of podcast in the future. I mean, it is very different, absolutely, and I think. I feel like the one type of creativity can sort of feed the other, because making a record, which we still do as Blitz, you know, we still make albums periodically. Those end up feeling like this sort of necessary catharsis for us, because working in film music, it can be really inspiring and cool that you are obviously collaborating with great creatives, with great directors and writers, and making something that is like the lifeblood of a film, like you say, and you have sort of certain marks to hit. Like for example, with Queens of the Dead, that is a film that Tina right off the bat had such a clear vision for, and talked about the touch points of like the electronic music and the house music, but also the vintage zombie feeling and how the type of synths that, you know, she would want to approach. It was so fun to write for because it was she's very encouraging and really gave us enough room to create our own voice with it. But also, there's clearly a mark to hit. We're not going to go in and be like, never mind all that, here's an orchestral suite. So there's a box to write in, which is both very helpful, but also eventually it doesn't feel the same as being creative in the purest sense, it's the blank canvas creation. So I think that's the biggest difference for us, is that writing our albums is cathartic and in a lot of ways more difficult because there's not something to hit other than how am I feeling? And that's a question that will plague me for the rest of my life. It's a deep question, you know, how am I really feeling? How do we write together? What are we wanting to say with our music? Whereas those questions don't get asked as much for film because it's more like we know what we want the audience to feel here, and we're inspired to like write something that's really going to hit with people in this scene or in this whatever, but it's ultimately collaborative in a way that is beyond the usual collaboration that we're used to. So yeah, they're different. They feel like two sides of a coin. I'm glad we get to do both.
That's awesome. Not many people do. One usually do one or the other. It's very
Yeah.
rare that I mean, even like Dave Grusin, who's done jazz albums, than he did, you know, scored The Goonies, and you know, you're just like you're going,
Sure.
it's an interesting little story that he's telling there through everything, so.
Yeah, 100%. And this is something we ended up learning after we started getting into this business, is like, oh, okay, there are other people who have done sort of what we're doing in the past. There's, you know, obviously Trent Reznor is a big example of someone who was in a band forever and now is such a celebrated film composer. But also like guys like Danny Elfman, you know,
Yeah.
Oingo First. Like there's the band guy to film composer pipeline is not totally untried, which I think gave us the confidence once we started doing it, being like, okay, maybe we do belong here. We can play ball.
Yeah, that's cool. Love
Yeah.
it.
Well, when you talk about emotions, I feel like, you know, that art, the way art elicits emotion is like that's the best outcome for something. You should feel something. As a consumer, we feel a certain way, but as the creative and putting the broth and soup together. See, more food. This is great. The idea that like what motivates you, is it is it conversations with the director? Do you have dinner and you talk over the film? Do you like to read a script and imagine things in your head, or do you need to see dailies to be like, yep, this now I get what you're going after?
Yeah, it depends on the project. Can be all of the above. I think our favorite approach is to be brought in fairly early in a process. So definitely meeting the director is a big part of it, and reading the script is a big part of it. Ideally before they've started rolling on anything, and then we can write in the closest to that pure form I'm talking about, where there's direction but nothing is cemented enough yet. So we can really experiment in there. We can experiment by writing emotionally, writing character themes, and responding to the script and responding to the way the director talks about it. The best case scenario for us there is when we're writing and then we're giving a bunch of stuff to the director. By the time he or she is filming, they're listening to our sketches and our ideas and our suites and giving us feedback on them. And they may influence some decisions and also feel like a more natural part of the DNA of the film. So by the time it's all shot and edited and we're going to start scoring to picture, usually there's enough of a vocabulary there that we can get fairly close.
Well, on that note, when coming from the trailer world and having to hit it fast, do you find that your ideas, whether it's with Steven or Tina or Mike, do you feel like you got a good gauge on things at the beginning of the process, or do you kind of find a theme at the end and go, oh God, stop the train, we gotta now retrospectively put put it, put together backwards. We're gonna go skin first and then the bones.
I mean, honestly, both. Like we certainly try to do it the first way. Like the best thing to, the best case scenario is we're writing these themes up front and then they're really clicking with the film and working. But it's certainly happened that we've gotten to, the climax of a film and a theme coalesces in a way we weren't expecting, and it'll really catch the director's ear and be like, oh, we really need to be teasing that earlier. Like that could be, part of the sound. So there's a lot of that give and take. We like to be very collaborative with the directors that we work with. So we're not coming in and being like, pretentiously like, here's my score, good luck or something. It's very much a dialogue, which I think maybe comes naturally to us from being in a band. It feels like we're just adding a member to the band basically, and they're very much an equal player at the table.
Gotcha. Well, going back to what you said, or just bringing up the idea about Elfman, somebody asked him, I forget which movie it was, he said, why don't we score this with marimbas? And it's like, well, I wonder where that idea came from. He's like, oh, I guess we can try that. But if somebody comes to you for your proficiency, but then asks you something to kind of like, it's not really my comfort zone, I guess, how much do you have to kind of put your not ego away, but just say, okay, well, this is where you're going. Let's try this. And then you bring in the experience, be like, you know what? I know you like electronic music, but this BPM is just too damn fast or something like that. Like, how do you cross that bridge?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, again, the answer can vary a lot, especially depending on the personality dynamic and the relationship with the director. But I would say that if a director comes to us, one of the best things a director can have, I think, for us is a vision that they really know, not necessarily a specific instrument, but they really know what they want their film to feel like and sound like. And they know that, like, without a doubt. That's one of the best things. So if they came to us and said something like, this one, I just love the marimba. The sound of that is so special to me. Can we please have marimba in this film? But it's coming from a place of like, that's because this is what the film needs and that's what they're excited about. That kind of becomes an exciting thing for us, being like, well, we don't do a lot of marimba scores, but what would the Blitz Berlin approach to marimba be like? What can be sometimes frustrating on the other end of things is if there isn't a vision and the marimba question is more like, well, we've tried everything else, so maybe marimba. And then it's like, okay, now we're searching in a way that is going to make it a little more difficult to land. But yeah, I think most of the time, most of the collaborators we work with, when they're bringing us something specific like that about an instrument they love or a tone they love, that can be an inspiring and fun thing to tackle. What would you say, Diener?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And we just did three movies that were vastly different, and all different directors with different vibes that they wanted. In one case, lots of tribal drums. In another case, lots of synths. And in the third case, try to do a little bit of a John Williams style score for a Deathstalker. So those were vastly different. But particularly with Silent Night, Deadly Night, I really enjoyed that process because Mike had a good vision for the movie, and we did off the bat. We had a very short timeline, so it was much shorter to get to score the entire movie. But once we got his vision, scoring it, during it, it really took us out of our comfort zone scoring. But we really, really think that he created an environment for us to create a way stronger score and a completely different approach in production and everything. When we were talking technical, making tones way more dry, not echoed and verbed as much, and such things as that. But yeah, I love it. I love having the extra brain, because it, like I said, it takes us out of our comfort zone and helps us think of things creatively, differently.
Totally.
Yeah, and you gotta love a director when they do allow that.
Exactly. Having a vision but allowing you to really make your own path within it is sort of the wonderful balance that I think the best directors hold. And we're very lucky to work with directors who are so good at that. Diener's right, those three films could not be more different tonally. I don't think this may be an exaggeration, but it doesn't even feel like there's an instrument in common between them. They're so in their own,
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah.
In their own pockets. Yeah, Deathstalker being this John Williams, Danny Elfman, like operatic symphonic thing, two Queens of the Dead, rhythmic synth, to Silent Night, Deadly Night, which is very minimal and probably one of our maybe scariest scores at times, because of how minimal and unsettling it is. And like, those could not be more different, those approaches. It really helps with getting stuck in a rut. It's kind of hard to get stuck in a rut as a composer, because you're always being told to do something that is that is quite different.
Can a composer be typecast?
I mean, I think you can. I think it's something we've fought against a little bit, and I don't know, you guys maybe you can tell us how we're doing on that front, but we love working in genre film, and we love the films that we score. There's been times when we'll do three or four scores in a row that are all asking for the same type of moody modern score, and it's definitely a concern, being like, we like to write a lot of different stuff, we like to experiment, we like to push our boundaries. I don't want to get stuck in a place where people are coming to us for this one sound.
Right. Yeah. And that brings me, like, you've already spliced punk into cinema and orchestrated chaos into beauty in the music world. But is there a genre you've yet to conquer? One still sitting there untouched, waiting for the Blitz Berlin treatment?
That's a good question. Once again, wonderfully phrased. Man, somebody's got to, like, you got to, can you write our bio or something? Like, I feel like.
Yeah. I'm here for you.
Okay, perfect. Love it. I don't know, Diener, what have we not tackled?
Well, we haven't really done comedy films. I'll say that. That's true. Like, a lot of them, at least.
Genre-wise, comedy. I'm thinking, like, music genre, though, you know? Like, what's we've done a lot of hip-hop. We've done pop and dance stuff and orchestral stuff and industrial.
Still have to do country, you know, so we should probably get on that.
Oh, yeah. Although we've done a little bit of country, a little bit of hard rock.
That's true.
You, sometimes where we get to really play in these different worlds is inevitably on indie films, a lot of times the budget by the end of it can't afford some of the needle drops that they have in the film that are like diegetic. So like the characters are in a bar and there's something playing in the background. So something that we end up having a lot of fun with in the very final stages is creating these fake bands that then we can put on the radio in the films. And so we have a country band with a song called El Camino, a band called the Arkansas Credit Card. Totally rock.
The Arkansas Credit Card? That sounds like a sex position.
It does. You know what it is? Okay, this is great, actually. I got it from a documentary about blues musicians touring back in the day in the South and having like no money whatsoever to get to the next show. And one of the questions asked to one of these older blues musicians was like, how did you guys stay on the road if you had no money at all? And the guy's answer was, you can tour as long as you want, as long as you got the Arkansas credit card. And I was like, what's that? And he's like, hose in a bucket. So he's siphoning gas out of cars. That's the Arkansas credit card. Wow. So anyway, it's a quick sidebar. But I think, to speak personally, I think one of the genres I'd like to tackle, also just in terms of arrangement and being able to record something, I guess, because it's not cheap, would be something like opera and choir, like large group vocal arrangements, and also large group symphony arrangements, because most of the times films don't have budgets for those things. We often write for them, but then have to find our own tricks and ways of making them work in our mixes without the availability of that. But I would love to arrange for a live full choir. That'd be
Yeah, when we do live strings, generally we hire quartets to do a bunch of layers, because just the budget and everything. So
that would hopefully someday we get the chance. There's a line item in our contract that says live orchestra budget or whatever, and then we can go to town on that. That'd be amazing. So someday.
That's cool. And I talking with y'all, you're both buried in a good way in everything music and musical. And I believe that you probably have your own record or music collection. And for mischievous sake, I do believe every good record collection has its oddities, kind of like the album you keep, not because you play it often, but because it's kind of a conversation starter. So what's the strangest, most curious record in recording in your own collection, the one that raises eyebrows when you pull it off the shelf?
Ooh, okay. Are we talking vinyl? We're talking like LP specifically?
You could do an LP, you could do a recording. And just while you think, you know, I found one of Stephen Hawking doing Monty Python on a record. I have it downstairs, and it is insane.
That is incredible.
Yeah, and also just like these oddities. And so, like, coming from the music business, is there a strange personal curiosity in your record collection?
That's pretty good. That's a good question. All right, I think I got two in mind, so I'll say one, Diener, then you say one, and then I'll finish with a different. All right.
Sure. Okay, go
All right.
ahead. Yeah.
So the first one, this isn't really music. This is more just like a straight up oddity. I don't know why I haven't thrown it out, but I was in a record store years ago and searching through for cool film scores. So I like to pick that sort of stuff up. I got a bunch of film scores on vinyl, and I find the score to Terminator 2. I'm like, sick. So dope, gotta get this. It's a big like double record, and I'm like, it's looks brand new, everything. I'm like, this is amazing. It was dirt cheap too, like suspiciously cheap. It was like $5. I'm like, okay, great, what a find. Get it home, and I hadn't had my record player set up at the time yet, so like I set it up a few weeks later, and eventually I'm like, now's the time. It's all set up. I'm gonna play Terminator 2, and so I pull it out, and instead of a vinyl record, it looks like a CD the size of a vinyl record, and I'm like, what the fuck? And then look at the back, I'm like, laser disc? No wonder it was $5. So I still have the Terminator 2 double laser disc here somewhere, and I've never owned a laser disc player. I don't know if you know anybody who has one who can play it, but
I've
there you
been so close to
go.
making that mistake too. I go to Half Price Books. I'm like, why are these still on the racks? Oh, yeah, because it's a fucking laser disc. Yeah.
Dude, man,
Same
that,
thing.
yeah, it's, it's turned into, like you say, a conversation piece because it is there as being like, why do you have a laser disc? I'm like, shut up. So,
I don't have an interesting one. I have a CD that just follows me to every house somehow, through every move, and it's just that it's a band. I have that Green Jelly CD that just follows me everywhere.
Dude,
the
Green
Jelly?
Little Pig, let me in.
Is it the Little Pig
Exactly.
one? Is it
Yes,
that?
that's the one. Yeah, and with Shit Man on it, or I think that's one.
Yes.
Yes. So that just
Dude.
fall for some reason, every time like I move places, I've moved quite a bit, I'll look in a box, I'm like, how is this here still?
Dude,
How
that's a
does this keep
good
coming with
answer.
me?
Man,
But
what
anyway,
a
that's
those were
mind.
re-released on vinyl for Record Store Day last year,
Really?
I believe. And yeah, no, Little Pig, Let Me In was a childhood staple.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I
yeah.
Yeah.
remember having the cassette. Was it the album called like 333 or something like that? Or
Oh,
was it
man.
666? I don't know, whatever it was, it was
But
333.
I'm trying to remember the album name, but I remember like
I
the
know.
artwork was
Yeah.
so like punk
Yes.
rock for all of them. It was so
Punk rock, but
good.
like very cartoon also. Like,
Yeah,
yes.
it was like goo
It was
on
like a
it. I don't
goo
know.
monster
Yeah,
or something, right?
yeah.
Yeah. And
Oh,
wasn't
such
it?
a good answer.
Is it
Green
like,
Jelly follows you.
isn't that like a Danny Carey side project from Tool? Didn't he drum in that band?
I don't know. I didn't know
I
that.
remember hearing this at that time. I've never verified it, but I
Right.
feel like there was a thing around Green Jelly where it was sort of a project that like various people subbed in with, and it was Tool adjacent in some way, I think.
That's epic as hell.
Yes,
Oh, freaking,
it
somebody is gonna fact check me on that and tell me I'm full of shit, which is
I'm
fine.
gonna fact check you after this,
Okay,
so
good.
yeah.
But what I will say in terms of very odd recordings, which would be conversation pieces, and something that I think only the three of us have came about because of Deathstalker. And so basically, as you know, Slash is a producer on Deathstalker. And when we heard that, like we've worked on films before that have, kind of celebrity producers, but typically that means that this person puts some money towards the film and then they'll show up at the premiere or something. Like they're more silent partners usually. But that's not the case with Slash. He's very passionate about Deathstalker and really, really sort of nerding out on the production values and all this sort of stuff. So right off the bat, we're like, well, Slash is in the mix. Like, would he play guitar for us in the score? Asked over email, and instantly he was just kind of like, sure, what do you need? Like, let's get on a Zoom. So got to Zoom with Slash, talked to him about everything. And he was just the most excited, collaborative person about it. Just being like, oh, it'd be cool if we tried this, and what about this? And anything we asked, he was just like, yeah, man, just like send it to me in a list, I'll jam it out. So what we asked for was there's a couple of tracks in that film that we needed lead guitar on that was like somewhat specific. Like we need like a tapping solo here, we need a shredding thing here, whatever. And he nailed all that in one take, of course. The guy's incredible, no surprises there. But the other thing was like, well, the whole score itself, it'd be nice to have a personality of guitar in here. Like it feels like it throws back to this Sword and Sandals era where like even though we're in medieval mode, like there's gonna be like some dive bombs or some pick scrapes going into action scenes and stuff, and it all just feels a little bit metal. So I was like, anything you can give us that would just be like some pieces that we could use throughout the film texturally. And he was like, no problem, got you. So he sends us, we get his tracks that are great. And then there's this mysterious track, the last one, which is a single wave file, which is 20 minutes long. And it's just Slash, the legend himself, sitting in front of the guitar amp with a microphone, going to town. I'm talking insane dive bombs, shredding, solos, just but like experimenting too, doing stuff with octopedals and delays and trying to create strange sounds. And so much of that is in the score. So much of his sonic DNA is in there. But I think we're the only three people on the planet that have a 20-minute private jam session from Slash in file form.
Well, we'd like to think that, I'm sure. I'm
we'd
sure
like to think. Do, but... I mean, we're the only guys who have that one, at least.
That's true. There you go.
But, yeah. So that would be a very unique oddity in our Sonic collection at the moment.
I'd like to sit around your coffee table and just, like, crank that up to 11 and, like, Back to the Future speakers blow out.
Man, 100, it's wild to listen to. If you guys are ever out in Los Angeles, if we ever have you by the studio, I will not let it leave here, but we can definitely listen to it here together.
Oh, no, I'll definitely be in touch. Absolutely, I'd love to hear that. It is awesome.
Well, talk to me about Deathstalker, because that was another film that showed at Fantastic Fest, and it made waves. Now, I had a funny experience. There was no music or sound for the first maybe 5-6 minutes, so the whole intro and Deathstalker walking into, not by fault of yours, of course, so don't freak out, Dean, Martin. So I'm watching it and I'm going, this is kind of cool. And it wasn't until the troll came in that the people running the booth were like, well, we got a problem in Theater 5. So they redid it. So I was watching it and it was kind of neat. I was like, I almost get to see what it would be like with you guys experiencing something with, you know, a blank plate. So I was curious, like, when do you know something's working, you know, specifically about Deathstalker? And in another time, when do you find that, you know, like peanut butter and jelly, they're great on their own, but when you put them together, it's fireworks. There are other times you listen to scores like, you know what? I like it, but outside the movie, it's not really doing anything. It needs the picture to be something. So
sure.
Do you have experiences like that?
Man, that's a great question. And what a unique experience, too. I didn't realize that about the false start. Did they start it over with
full? Oh, they did, yeah, volume? Yeah.
Okay. That's good. Because I feel like the opening of that film, musically, is very, very key. All the choirs and everything. But yeah.
It's the foreplay, yeah. We had to go back and do it all over again.
I mean, watching a film with no mix, especially in a rough cut or no music or whatever, is always a strange experience. And that's, you know, something you got a glimpse of there. And certainly it's a weird experience for us. Some directors cut with tent music, some don't. And sometimes it's completely silent, and you really have to use a lot of imagination when watching it in terms of developing that. In terms of marrying those elements, I mean, it's such a complex and sort of responsive and instinctual process as you go. I think the goal is always to make a film score that someone could go out of the theater and listen to afterwards, enjoy on its own, and also like make them feel the way the movie made them feel. Like that would be, I think, the goal with any score that we make. I think some scores live better in that world than others. There's definitely some that are more, you know, minimal and textural and droney, which probably aren't for like the general public their idea of like putting on at a party. but I think in general with our scores, we're trying to do justice to what's on screen, but I always want the musicality, the writing, the themes, the changes to be sonically interesting and evocative enough that you're going to be able to listen to it. And it to bring you back to the place that you were at when you watched the film the first time. It's always the goal. Whether or not we succeed is something you guys would know better than we would. I hope that it succeeds that way.
Yeah, well, yeah, you wouldn't get the Axe Wound track without that. You wouldn't get Slash's contributions without that. And like the pieces that you put into the pie all really make for something that does. They are takeaways, but. Speaking just to that, are there times what's pushed you out of your comfort zone? Like what's made you question, is this gonna work? And then once you see it put together, you're like, yeah, damn, you know, Mike was right, Tina was right, you know, Dean was right, you know?
Sure. I mean Diener made a great point earlier talking about Silent Night, Deadly Night with that, where I think that was a score for us. I know we're a ways out, so we shouldn't talk about it too much, but pushed us into a kind of minimalism that we're not often asked for in scores. A lot of the times the scores, the notes are like, let's punch up this moment. Like this needs to be, you know, this has to be funnier, this has to be scarier, this has to be more exhilarating. So a lot of times it's finding ways to make things feel bigger and higher budget and more cinematic, more exciting, all that sort of stuff. Whereas a lot of the time with the process of Silent Night, Deadly Night, we would lay in our pieces and Mike would be like, this is amazing, this is really working, but let's hear what it sounds like when we take away 8 of the 10 elements. Like, let's dial it way, way, way back. So we just have the bare bones of what you're doing, and let's use it really intentionally as opposed to having it all throughout the scene. So I think that is not a common request that we get. That was a comfort zone thing for us, where we start, at least for me, I can speak personally, of being like, but it's so empty now, you know? What's like, it feels like we've, you know, this, we've made a mistake musically here or something, like there's not enough going on. And it took, I think, the better part of a few days of doing this to start hearing the way the film, the way he was hearing it, and being able to think about the psychology and the mood here that he was going for, and how it's much better served by minimalism. So that felt like, I mean, there's films that feel almost a bit like music school, where like we're relearning some things that we thought we knew, and parts of Silent Night, Deadly Night felt like that. What would you say, Chase?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And just back to Mike and his direction, so some of it was interesting, just some of the tones that we had subtly in there because they're too abrasive or something. He would come back with, I want that to be 11 out of 10 loud, you know, yeah, something like that.
That's our tone, get rid of the other stuff.
Yeah, and us, take yeah. away the other stuff. And it was interesting listening back. I'm like, yeah, this makes it way scarier. Like, this is yeah. like a cool direction. So I really appreciate that type of view from him. And yeah, no, I'd say you hit it right on, Marty.
Yeah, I'd say with these recent films, especially, I think with Deathstalker, there was challenges for sure, but this is our fourth film with Steve. And we have a good dialogue in terms of what he's expecting and how that's going to go. It's always pushing it further, but it's not something we're unfamiliar with. This is our first collaboration with Tina Romero on Queens of the Dead, but also it was enough in this pocket of music that we've made this synthwavy, moody thing with some of these fun beat elements that it felt very natural as well. Comfort zone, the challenging one was Silent Night, Deadly Night, but we feel very happy with the result.
Awesome. I love that. Yeah. And, you know, just talking with you over this last hour here, first off, I feel like we're instant friends. Did we just become best friends? Also, it's clear, I think, just not only to me and Mark, but to our listeners, that y'all are cinematic aficionados. Like, you love the film, you love the music. So are there any particular moments or a scene or a musical moment in a film that has always stuck with you, that's helped shape your creative life, that you wake up and you say, oh shit, I'm thinking about this moment and fuck yeah, I'm gonna go to work.
So sorry, cinematic moments in films that we're fans of, like in
yes. So like, while you're thinking about it, I can say that one of mine that really got me to do film and do music at some part in my life was Jerry Goldsmith in the 80s film Explorers. And it was the spaceship launching off. Like, that just has like just this quality of telling the story of these kids building a tilt-a-whirl into a spaceship. And cool. I love that moment. And then it's like, okay, this is a film score. And then, you know, I got to know the John Williams and everything else. But I like that musical moment in a movie that's always still like there.
Yeah, musical, I'd say for bigger films, any hair-raising thing for me, you know, the Duel of Fates from Star Wars Phantom Menace, you know, that's a very obvious one. Another obvious one would be Moneyball when he hits the home run and that subtle score comes in rather than a huge bombastic one. It's just so effective. Back to Star Wars, what was, I can't remember the name of the one where Darth Vader only comes in at the end of the new one.
Oh, at the end of Rogue One. You're
thinking Rogue One, right. And yeah, so that one, another very effective moment just to hear him breathe, and it's less musical, and then his theme comes in for the first time. I like those hair-raising moments, so that would be my type of thing. I'm super into that type of vibe.
Yeah, me too.
Man, those are great, great moments. I think I'm realizing that like a lot of my instincts are, they lean so much more into this, maybe because I grew up on movies like Commando, like I was mentioning, and Big Trouble in Little China, that there's something about like, and Indiana Jones, there's something about the like adventure scores that just I really love, and I love that kind of music. And here's a moment that I think about way too much for some reason. It's in True Lies. You guys like the movie?
Oh, it's one of the best movies. I think it's the best action movie still ever made.
Okay, it's the yeah, maybe the best, also the best James Bond movie that's not a James Bond movie, basically.
Yeah.
Then, you know, man, I'm glad to hear you say that. I love that movie. I watch it at least once a year. Love it to death. There's specifically the moment on the bridge, obviously, amazing bridge scene, where you know, Arnie's hanging from the helicopter, Jamie Lee Curtis in the limo after the driver's dead. It's out of control. The Harrier jets are blowing up the bridge. She's gonna drive right over the edge. And there's the whole suspenseful bit where he's trying to grab her hand, and the limo keeps crashing into stuff, and he can't. And she's, you know, screaming for him. And there's this action score that's building throughout that whole part, and it's, you know, exciting and it's fun and whatever. And then there's the moment when she sees that, like, it's the last possible second. And she looks up at him and they make eye contact, and it's like the close up of both of them in the hand. And that's when the score switches into that triplet thing. That, like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
And we're like, come on, baby, or whatever he says in that moment. And then she just grabs his hand as the car goes over, and it goes from this danger momentary score change, which I don't think we hear elsewhere in the film. It's this really special moment that then blossoms into this like relief and heroism as they fly off into the sunset together. That moment to me is just like cinematic brilliance. I love that movie.
It
Sorry.
is. I'm just like getting goosebumps, you know, thinking about that moment.
Oh.
And I mean, and as somebody who loves True Lies, I'm not telling a tale out of school really here. I quote True Lies on a daily basis with my friends, not for the line you probably think it is. It's definitely like ass like a 10-year-old boy
Oh
line
my God, dude.
from
Paxton in
Bill
that
Paxton.
movie. Oh my God. He's so incredibly so horrible. He's just, oh.
No, that whole scene with him is so good, but it's also like you make me think about that, you know, like even Big Trouble in Little China, and it doesn't fit anywhere, but it's like that John Carpenter, that little chord that he plays, that dear narrow barrel, and it's like the weirdest sci-fi rock western sound that he perfected in that, and it's like, well, it just comes up here and there,
Man,
and
absolutely. I love Escape from LA for that too. There's like
yes.
those guitar moments in that like when he's first, you know, call me Snake, and he's getting put in the tube to get shot to the island, whatever. Like, it's clearly John Carpenter in a room being like, this is sick. You know, love it.
No, I love that. Thank you. I like that, hearing those musical moments that inspire you. So that's great.
I will quickly add on top of that, not outside of film. We are video game geeks a little bit. So some
Definitely.
cinematic moments that really stuck with me are just even firing up Final Fantasy VII or Ocarina
Oh.
of Time, or in modern day Elden Ring, those menus and just the vibe right off the bat. A lot of our melodies are definitely influenced by playing these video games as a child.
No, it's what it is.
They were unbelievable.
Yeah, those operatic choir ones. Like, think of Halo 3. You hear that
Yes. Oh.
operatic Halo moment. You know, you just, it sounds there. Yeah, no, oh man, Ocarina of Time. My goodness.
Oh man, there's moments, actually speaking of cinematic video games, there's moments in Halo Reach specifically that I feel like are some of the best moments that have ever been in a sci-fi anything. Like they beat a lot
Right,
of
yeah.
movies. Like Reach has some moments that are just so powerful. One honorary mention, video game wise, that I think has one of the more brilliant scores in recent years is Disco Elysium. Can't get enough of that score. It's by a band called Sea Power, and it's just so melancholy and beautiful and perfect for this fully unique little game. I love that game.
Oh,
Love
I'm
that
gonna have to
score.
check that out because I like the video game scores. So that
Yeah,
sounds
man. Yeah, it's excellent.
that's
Do
cool.
you guys ever play Symphony of the Night?
Oh,
Castlevania
yeah.
Symphony
Are
of the
you kidding
Night?
me? Absolutely. In fact, I just got gesturing towards my PS5 off screen here. I just got the whatever it's called, the bundle where it's the reissue of Symphony of the Night they did for PS4 or
Oh,
whatever.
sweet.
You know, it's still the same graphics as the PS1
Yeah.
game, but that game was like borderline religious for me. I played that so much as a kid. And great music.
And there's such
Sweet.
like a such a concoction of themes that are, you know, pulse pounding and hair raising, and then you get like the save sounds and music and stuff like that. But I was playing the game, I remember I was in college, and it blew my effing mind when you had the upside down castle. Like
I was just thinking about that moment. Yeah.
I was
Which
keeping track of
quit the
like, you
game
know, my
without even
progress.
ever finding, right? Yeah.
And so I was like, it just totally blew away your expectations and, you know, made it a trip worth having again, upside down. And like, I think the, you know, Soul Steel, and then, you know, all the forms of
Oh,
Alucard. I was
wow.
like,
That's
ah, oh,
like a
fucking
vocal
love
stem that just brought back some things.
that.
Man, absolutely. And that game specifically is a combination of the kind of like Baroque, like harpsichord sounding music, and then with like the somewhat more modern video game music at moments is so powerful. And I find it so cool earlier video games like that. Obviously, that one was more complex than you could get away with on an SNES, but the same kind of limitations in a lot of ways, where like you couldn't really do what you can now and have a full Elden Ring orchestra or something like that. Some of those old film scores of those or those old video game scores with limitations are so cool to me, like Chrono Trigger or the old like Final Fantasy VI for the SNES, which is, you know, all on these 8-bit, 16-bit little chips. They can make these beautiful thematic scores within there that are still haunt me and
Well, the
are so
Mario
cool.
theme is just wild too.
Oh yeah.
Mario theme is very interesting when you think about it, but yeah, to make that is
100%.
pretty creative.
Yeah, it's
Well,
cool.
for me, it's DuckTales because I played
Oh
that. I
yeah.
remember having chicken pox, and my parents were like, "You can't go downstairs and play because you're sick." And as soon as they left the house in the summer, I was like, "Dun dun dun dun," and just
Sure,
went
sure,
down
sure.
and played DuckTales. But I didn't realize until Jake Kaufman redid the score for DuckTales Remastered that each of them were written in a style that was like jazz and, you know, rock and kind of, and I forget the other themes, but like I never noticed that. And so I'm curious, like now that you guys are pros and you've been doing this, are there things you notice now, like I know how they did that, or I'd always wondered, you know, what that instrument was, but now you've seen behind the curtain, you fig you know, you're reverse engineering it, the things that you loved growing up.
I think definitely with more modern film scores, there's been a lot of those realizations for sure. Of being like, especially with something like John Williams, his specific way of using French horn and flute and stuff like that, which I wouldn't have been able to name when I was a kid necessarily, but just give you those goosebumps and when they're in a certain melody range, and definitely learned a lot of stuff like that. Counterpoint is not that long ago, I got excited about learning how some of the SNES music was made for the old Super Nintendo systems, and the more I learned about it, the more I just became like horrified to realize that like I don't know anything about this. I don't think I could do this. Like this is insane. It's basically more like writing code than it is composing music. And they didn't even have something like reverb or delay. If they wanted something like a sound to sound like it had reverb on it, you would create the sound and then create like 100 versions of the sound at decreasing volumes to try to give the effect of a reverb tail, because there was no echoing sounds. It was not technology that you could include. So that one made me feel like, never mind, I don't know anything. It's very
That's
complicated. What about you,
good.
Cheese?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a tough one to answer, but yeah, we're constantly trying to reverse engineer tones, anything that we hear. I mean, back to that Wraith sound with the hydraulic, we were trying to make that Lord of the Rings kind of scream with that. And I thought we got pretty close, but yeah, no, that's a tough one for me.
Good point, actually, with the reverse engineering thing. A recent example would be on Deathstalker. One of the things that both Steve and us are huge fans of the Doom video games, and obviously huge fans of Mick Gordon, and like those scores are incredible. They
Yeah.
sound incredible. Like the production is very, very difficult to compete with. Mick's a genius. But there's a couple moments in Deathstalker where we're like, we want this to sound as much like that, like ear candy level of heaviness that Mick Gordon manages to nail. So again, you guys tell us how we did on that, but there was a lot of effort put into trying to be like, this has to sound world-endingly heavy, baritone guitars, 100 of them stacked up in stereo fields, just like, you know, really give the sauce.
Cool.
Yeah, that's certainly something we're still doing to this day, is trying to figure out how these guys pull that off.
Love that. It's
Well,
awesome.
I think cinema goers are going to have an incredible time this fall, because you have Death Slayer coming out in a couple weeks. You've got Queens of the Dead coming out the end of October, and then Silent Night, Deadly Night, the end of the year. We love seeing stuff, but taking stuff home as consumers is like it's our lifeblood. Have you had any talks with vinyl producers or manufacturers about taking and spinning your soundtracks?
100% yes. On all three films, we are currently having those discussions. So unfortunately, there's nothing I can confirm or announce at this point, but there are still some great vinyl distributors that are in this game that work with genre films. As with a lot of things, the market is sort of shrinking all the time for that. They're collector's items. It has to be, you know, the right timing and all that sort of stuff. But long story short, it is in progress. Hopefully, there will be soundtracks released for all three, but we'll see.
Okay. What is your favorite format? I've actually kind of gotten, Brian got me into vinyl about 7 years ago. And since I'm stuck at the desk every day, I have a record player, but I've also started to get back into all my CDs. I mean, I've got Chrono Cross, Blood Diamond, Home Alone, these things I haven't listened to in a long time.
Dude, so, Chrono Cross soundtrack? That's
I do. It's a three disc.
He's like, nerd.
That's amazing.
Look,
no,
I got,
that's so,
I got
that's,
wow.
Shenmue.
Oh, yeah.
Chrono Cross. And this is probably my favorite soundtrack of all time is Ridge Racer 4 for the PS4.
Oh, oh cool.
Man. Oh, yeah. Man. Wow. Okay. You were out nerding us, and that doesn't happen a lot. That's impressive.
I'm going to go find my orthopedic shoes, guys.
That's killer, man. That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I think I collect vinyl, got vinyl here. I mean, I don't know. Out of sheer convenience these days, I just fall back to, you know, having the, we listen to so much music all the time and are referencing so much, is just having, you know, Spotify to the Sonos system, whatever in the house, to be totally honest. But when it comes to collecting something physical, I love having a vinyl because I love the size of the artwork too. And a lot of the special releases now, you know, will come with a poster or some sort of unique content along with it. And that feels to me like the most fun way to collect.
It's the warmest sound too. Yeah, we're kind of in the music geek world. So I listen on my studio speakers most of the time because you can differentiate the orchestra a little bit better. You can hear the violas from the violins and all that. But in terms of warm feeling, the vinyl, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I think so.
You can't roll a joint on an MP3.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
I will say one CD I do still have somewhere that I am happy about is a CD that I bought like in grade 10 when Kid A came out. It's got Kid A.
Hell yeah.
Like the first release of it, it was right when it came out. I was so excited, you know, big OK Computer fan. I was just really getting into alt music at that time. And I got my hands on Kid A, listened to it, loved it many years. And then like a decade later, there was some article written about the first pressing of Kid A and how it was so special because there was a hidden booklet under the CD tray.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? And then went back to the CD I'd had for 10 years and, you know, busted open the jewel case. And there's an entire artwork booklet that had been hiding in there the whole time. That felt like a special collectible thing that I've still hung on to.
Love that, Radiohead. That's good.
Yeah. And actually, I recently got my hands finally on a copy of this isn't music, but SNES cartridge of Chrono Trigger. So I do have that. That's a collector's thing that I'm proud of.
That's amazing. That's great.
That is not an easy thing. I've wanted that for a long time. That's not an easy thing to get. And that's one of my favorite games of all time.
That's cool. I love it.
Well, Dean, what do you have that makes you smile, makes you like, you know, walk a little taller?
What do I have? Oh, man. Well, other than my video game collection, that's a tough one. My dad is a huge Beatles junkie, so generally a lot of Beatles around the house. But also my partner, she plays music, so I'm gonna cheat and say her records.
Very sweet. Look at this sweet man. It's community property.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
But that will be my cheater answer.
That's great.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's very good. Yeah. It's very cool.
Well, guys, I think we've taken up enough of your time. We don't want to keep you from making amazing music that you're going to put out into the atmosphere and will echo in eternity. I do have one more question. As you've come up in the world as a DIY trio, what's the most DIY thing you think you've ever done? Whether it is producing your first album or coming up with the watch sampling, you know, like what's one thing that if you did a traditional route or you had infinite resources, just wouldn't be the same?
You're specifically asking about like a musical element, a DIY musical element, like something sonic.
Yeah.
That's a great question. That's a really good question.
It's kind of like, just... sorry to interrupt. There's a movie called Tomorrowland. It's a Brad Bird's movie about the future, and the beginning of the movie is a kid building a rocket pack, and he's like, And Hugh Laurie's character asks him why he made it. And he's like, I got tired of waiting for somebody to do it for me. So I've always had that mindset. I mean, there's a couple of custom vinyls that I've done artwork and had cut on places that rhyme with Etsy. And so just like, the stuff that you had to do to sort of fulfill your vision and get it out there.
I just come back to that. You said it earlier, so it's a little bit of a cheat answer too. But to start one of our albums for our old band, our old punk rock band, Martin going up to the observatory and with his phone recording the observatory opening for the beginning of the album with that creepy sound. I mean, that's one of the coolest things, I think. Things that we captured, but do it yourself. It's tough to think of more. How about you, Marty?
I mean, yeah, there's so many examples over the years. The one that jumps to mind for me, just because it's quite recent, is working on Alien Earth. So we were working on the trailer side for that one. Excuse me. And
So you didn't work with Jeff Russo on that. You guys were lone wolfing it again, right?
very much lone wolfing
Okay,
it,
gotcha.
working with FX in their their marketing department, really. But a lot of it had to do with creating original sounds for the trailers and creating this whole suite of sounds that felt like authentically in the world of Alien, but also were fresh and new. Both sounds that were like alarms and things, which are hydraulics and our recordings came in handy for that stuff, but also creating stuff that felt a little creature adjacent. And we were really bending over backwards trying to figure out how to do that and make something really unique, like bending or scraping piano strings, or even trying to make weird sounds with our own voices and stuff. But one of the things that really came in handy is there's a raven that lives like just outside my house, basically in one of these trees. He comes by daily, and I have to close the door because I'm trying to mix, and he's always coming and making raven sounds. It was one of those moments where I was like, wait a second, this guy's a star. And his like, I can't even do them, but the like combination of click and like, thing that like ravens can do that just sounds whatever. So we basically recorded as much of him as possible whenever there wasn't a helicopter going over, being Los Angeles, trying to get an isolated recording of him. And that ended up making its way into a texture that was really useful in our Alien Earth work. So that's a recent experimental approach to something that that we weren't sure exactly how to pull off.
Yeah,
So
that
it
was
was really
did we
cool.
credit that Raven? I can't remember.
He's non-union. I didn't know.
No SAG cards for him. Well, Dean Martin, please give Tristan her best. Tell him you missed out. We all became best friends. We're gonna come to each other's houses for Thanksgiving. He can't come, unfortunately, but we'll
Honestly,
have cake.
he's out of the band. He's out. You guys are in.
Yeah, we're kicking him out.
There you go. All right, perfect.
Bands work better when there's four. So I think we round each other out. We're Ghostbusters. We're great. So,
You ever seen a three-legged chair? I haven't.
Well, Brian, thank you for jumping back on this. From Brian and I in Dallas, Texas, we want to give you a yeehaw, a high five, and thank you so much for your time. And we will catch you next time.
And thank you for having us. This has been great. You guys have been
Yeah,
great.
thanks so much.